Views and opinions expressed on this program are those solely of its speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WMUA, its management board, or the Board of Trustees of the University of Massachusetts.
Welcome to a new edition of Tan Cerca, Tan Lejos. This is WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst. And this week is a fun drive here at WMUA. We would really like you to call and to contribute to WMUA. As you may know, WMUA does not rely on corporations, does not rely on advertising for getting its support. We rely on listeners like you, so we would really appreciate if you could call and you could contribute to WMUA. The phone number for doing that is 413-577-3000. You can get premiums if you contribute. You can get a mug if you contribute with $20, a CD. If you contribute with $30, you can get a T-shirt, a polka CD if you contribute with $35. A sweatshirt if you contribute with $60, and a polka grab bag if you contribute with $100, the same as if You also could get for $100 a WMUA grab bag and a deluxe jazz package. Let me also tell you, maybe for the people listening to my show, it is particularly interesting that you could get, if you contribute with $30, this DVD, this CD, the Cuban Masterworks Collection, We Are the Music, Nosotros la Música, The Golden Age of Cuban Music. All right, so that's the phone drive. Please call. We would really appreciate if you contributed to WMUA. We would appreciate your kind support. Now, let me tell you that I'm very happy to have here in the studio to Professor Ilan Stavans. Professor Ilan Stavans is the Lewis Severin Professor in Latin American and Latino Culture in Amherst College. He has a very well-known reputation. He has done contributions in the field of Spanglish, and I'm very happy he's here today. How are you, Ilan?
Muy bien, gracias. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really glad you're here. And we're going to speak today, mainly in English, a little bit in Spanish, about the last book you just edited, which is All the Odes of Neruda. It was published when?
Maybe not even a week ago.
So, Ilan, I would like you to speak a little bit more, just to begin, you know, a little bit more about the story of the book, you know?
Well, Pablo Neruda, as you know, is a fundamental poet of Latin America. He is one of the Nobel Prize winners, a poet that has defined the way we look at literature in general and literature connected with politics. He was born in 1914. He died in 1973, just as the coup against Salvador Allende by General Pinochet was taking place in Santiago de Chile, Chile being Neruda's country. And throughout my life, I have been really, maybe even obsessed with Pablo Neruda. It was a student of mine years ago who introduced me to the act of translating him. And it is particularly attractive to me one aspect of Neruda's work, and that is the odes, las odas. The ode is a form that goes back to Greek and Roman time. It is a celebration of mundane objects or objects that the poet wants to cherish and bring to the attention of the people. And Neruda is one of the 20th century practitioners. He produced some of the most beautiful odes, in my view, in any language, and certainly some of the most gorgeous odes ever written in the Spanish language. Throughout his life, he left us with altogether 225 odes, a very hefty, substantial number. He, during a period in his 50s, was writing an ode a week and publishing them in magazines, sometimes an ode a day. And they range from topics like the watermelon, la sandía, to salt, la sal, to the dictionary, to books, to a theater, to the lover's hands, to a city that he loves, like Santiago, or to his political heroes, some of which might not be our heroes today, Lenin, Stalin, Mao. He really was quite open about his political persuasion, and the odes are a way to see how Neruda lived life and how he expressed his own ideology, his opinion. So what I did in this book, and going back to your question, Leopoldo, is that I put together all the odes. They have never been published in a single volume in any language. Mm-hmm. In Spanish, they were published in three books, but also dispersed in other books that Neruda published, like Residencia en la Tierra, Residence on Earth, or Canto General. So they are all together in one book in English for the first time with the Spanish original. The Spanish original appears on the left and the English translation on the right, and there are 18 different translators. I have tried to select the most representative translations of his odes. Some of his odes have been so popular, like the ode to the dictionary or the watermelon or the onion, that they have been translated four or five times. And so this anthology brings all translations. Some translations are new, some odes have never been translated before, and when an ode was translated before on a number of occasions, I chose what I thought would be the most representative, not always the best, but the most representative.
Mm-hmm. Actually, now that you're mentioning, like, for example, these famous odes to the dictionary, to the watermelon, to the onion, maybe later it would be great if you could read them.
Of course.
But now, you know, I was wondering when I was reading the introduction to the book that you wrote, I was kind of interested in a particular phrase that you wrote in this introduction, in which you say that Neruda championed the significance of the insignificance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice phrase. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. Look, Neruda is a poet that really brings together different modes. Or maybe we could talk about him in a different way. We could say that different poets exist within the same body. He starts his career writing very beautiful romantic poetry in a very, very popular book called 20 Poemas de Amor y una Canción Desesperada, 20 love poems and a song of despair, arguably the most the best-selling poetry book in Latin America, the one we all use when we're young to declare our love to our first lover. And after that, he went through a series of mutations until he wrote an epic book called Canto General, in which he tried through poetry to tell the story and the history of all of Latin America. And by all, I'm not talking about time alone, but every single aspect, the pre-colonial times, the way minerals and the fauna and flora coexist together today in previous times, Machu Picchu, the place where the Inca Empire existed centuries ago, to dictators, to workers today, to housewives, to students. And after that, after having written such an ambitious book, Neruda opted to do something that I find just extraordinarily enlightening. He decided to start paying attention to objects that surround us every day, but to which we pay little attention. Say your shoelaces, or your toothbrush, or the glass that will contain the water that you will drink early in the morning, or your lover's hands, or the fingernails, or dirt. And so it is really the insignificance that all of a sudden he wants to bring to the fore and create poetry about it. So what you have in the odes is an emphasis on that to which we put little emphasis in life, the significance of the insignificance. And only Neruda, a man who has been able to be so ambitious, can do this, because he can focus on the large themes, but he can also reduce them to little themes. And those little themes become atoms or molecules through which we can see an entire cosmos.
You just commented to us that he wrote 225 odes, right?
He did.
That's a big number. Could you speak about? I guess it was a vast and long creation of, you know, process of creations of so many odes. If you could elaborate on that.
Well, think of the ode as your friend or as your companion. Mm-hmm. Instead of thinking of a task or of a chore that Neruda needed to do, write 225 odes throughout his life, I would think that he considered the ode his amigo or his amiga or his muse, his source of inspiration. And every time he saw another item around him, he decided that he was going to shape an ode and present it, because his purpose was to bring that particular object to the attention of people and to do it in a way that would make people see that object differently. For instance, he has a gorgeous ode to French fries, mm-hmm. to las papas fritas, to fried potatoes. And we eat them all the time. They are part of our diet. But what he does in that ode is take you through language to the act of the chef,
of cooking. First peeling the potato, then cutting them the way he wants them, then throwing them on the pan. He listens to the way the oil sprinkles around, dances on the pan, and looks at all these potatoes connecting one another in a dialogue. And what you end up seeing is the preparation of what you're going to eat later on. And I assure you, after reading La Oda a las Papas Fritas, you cannot eat French fries in the same way. All of a sudden, he has shown you that there's life, there's an anima, there's an alma, there's a soul in this item that we take for granted.
Quite interesting.
You know, you were also speaking about the political views of Neruda. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the relationship between, you know, his political views and the odes.
Sure.
There are quite a few political odes, I assume, right?
Well, it is absolutely right. It is no secret that Neruda professed his politics in a frontal way. He was a communist, a professed communist. Throughout his life, he used his poetry to champion the working class, the labor movement, and socialist or Marxist political leaders that he believed would bring change to society. He ended up partnering at the end of his life with Salvador Allende. He himself was a senator for a while. He was a cultural attaché. He was an ambassador. He was a consul. He was very connected with left-wing governments. This is a tradition, as you know, Leopoldo, in Latin America. We don't see writers the way they are often seen in the United States and in some places in Europe as entertainers, as those that are going to produce works that are going to make us escape from reality. Instead, the tradition, the political, ideologically compromised tradition of the writer in Latin America is that who is representing the oppressed, or those that don't have a voice, or those that can't speak out, those that are often marginalized or silenced. And Neruda is the archetype, the representative, the ultimate political writer. And yet, not all that he writes is politically open or engaged. On the other hand, even that which doesn't appear to be openly political seems to be political when you understand where Neruda is coming from. And certainly this happens with the odes. The odes can, you will probably hear later when I read an ode to the dictionary or an ode to the onion, what can be political about the dictionary or political about the onion. But you will see that there is a subtlety, there is a kind of underground message that makes you see that the onion will be the basic food of the common people, and he champions it because it the onion is unpretentious. The onion is just the way he wants to see people: simple, direct, grounded on earth. And when he talks about the dictionary, he says, you know, it can legislate, it can decide how language is going to be used, but I, Neruda, don't want anybody to legislate my language or the language of anybody. Everybody should choose their own language, and we should turn the dictionary into a tool for us to transform our language. So he adapts it, the message of each of these odes to his own needs.
All right. Ilan, let me play one song. I'm gonna play a Cuban song. I again invite people to contribute to WMUA. We are in the fund drive week. The phone number for doing that is 413-577-3000. You can also do it online on WMUA. So Ilan, let me play one song, and when we come back from the song, I would really appreciate if you could read maybe the O's to the, what do you like, the dictionary?
The dictionary.
All right. So let me play this song. This is a Cuban song, Lágrimas Negras.
¿Qué te importa que te ame si tú no me quieres ya? El amor que ya ha pasado no se puede recordar. fui la ilusión de tu vida. Un día, una noche, hoy represento el pasado, no me puedo conformar. Si las cosas que uno quiere se pudieran atrás, con qué tristeza miramos un amor que se nos va. Es un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad. Pasado no se debe recordar. Fui la ilusión de tu vida, un día o la noche. Hoy represento un pasado, no me puedo conformar. Si las cosas que uno quiere se pudieran alcanzar, si me quisiera lo mismo que 20 años atrás, con qué tristeza miramos un amor que se nos va. Es un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad. Se arranca sin piedad.
This program is made possible by listeners like you and by River Valley Market, your locally grown food co-op, located in Northampton, just south off I-91, exit 21 on North King Street. Featured items include house-made sausages, locally grown produce, an in-house deli, and a selection of wines and regional cheeses. Open 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. daily. Everyone is welcome. No membership is required. More information at www.rivervalleymarket.coop. WMUA thanks River Valley Market for their kind support.
Y bueno, bienvenidos de regreso a Tercerca Tan Lejos. Esa fue la de 20 años con Bebo y Sigalá. Estamos en la semana de recaudación de fondos aquí de la WMUA. Como usted sabe, WMUA no depende de las contribuciones comerciales, no dependemos de corporaciones, dependemos del apoyo de escuchantes como usted. Y estamos en la semana de recaudar fondos. Si usted gusta contribuir, hay premios que se puede ganar: CDs, tazas, camisetas. Un CD aquí que tengo que se llama La Edad de Oro de la Música Cubana. Y bueno, el número telefónico para hacer eso es 413-577-3000. Realmente apreciaremos mucho si contribuye. También lo puede hacer en línea en wmua.org. Y bueno, hablando un poquito en español, déjenme decirles que tengo aquí en el estudio, como usted quizás ya entendió del inglés, al profesor Ilan Stavans. Él es profesor Lewis Severin de Estudios Latino y Latinoamericanos, de Cultura Latina y Latinoamericana del Colegio de Amherst, aquí en Amherst. Y bueno, Ilan Stavans es un académico muy reconocido. Él ha hecho contribuciones en diversos campos. Creo que las contribuciones más famosas que ha hecho son en el campo del Spanglish. Y estábamos aquí hablando del último libro que acaba de editar. Me comentaba que apareció en la prensa creo que hace una semana, ¿no?
Uh-huh.
Que es Todas las odas de Pablo Neruda. Por primera vez en cualquier lenguaje, español, inglés o lo que sea, se pusieron todas las odas de Pablo Neruda en un libro singular. El libro en realidad tiene las odas en el lado izquierdo en inglés y en el lado derecho en español.
O viceversa.
Y bueno, antes de que fuéramos a la canción, quedé con Ilan, que me gustaría mucho que nos recitara un par de odas. Estábamos hablando de cómo Neruda hizo odas a cosas que son del día a día, y también hizo odas a otras cosas, digamos, más profundas. Y bueno, Ilan, estás al aire.
Muchas gracias, Leopoldo. Esta es una oda que escribió Neruda dedicada al diccionario, se llama La Oda al Diccionario. Y antes de recitarla quisiera invocar en los radioescuchas lo que es un diccionario. Ese compañero que tenemos a diario que junta entre dos cubiertas todas las palabras que usamos en nuestro vocabulario. Es un sueño quijotesco poder encerrarlas en un solo libro, y quijotesco porque es imposible hacerlo, ¿no? Hay muchas palabras que se inventan y que no pueden ser encarceladas de esa manera, y sin embargo el sueño del diccionario es poder contener las más posibles y servirnos de amigo, servirnos de Biblia, servirnos de qué. Esa es la pregunta que se hace Neruda, y también la pregunta es vista de una perspectiva cronológica. ¿Cómo vemos al diccionario cuando somos jóvenes, a diferencia de cuando ya tenemos más edad? Yo, en mi experiencia, cuando era joven, el diccionario me parecía una especie de lomo profético en el cual estaba la verdad, y ahora entiendo que el diccionario está hecho por humanos, que puede contener errores, que puede contener erratas, y que todo no cabe ahí, ni sabiéndolo acomodar. Oda al diccionario. Lomo de buey, pesado cargador, sistemático libro espeso. De joven te ignoré, me visitó la suficiencia y me creí repleto, y orondo como un melancólico sapo, dictaminé, recibo la palabra directamente del Sinaí bramante, reduciré las formas a la alquimia, soy mago. El gran mago callaba. El diccionario, viejo y pesado, con su chaquetón de pellejo gastado, se quedó silencioso sin mostrar sus probetas. Pero un día, después de haberlo usado y desusado, después de declararlo inútil y anacrónico camello, cuando por largos meses sin protesta me sirvió de sillón y de almohada, se rebeló y plantándose en mi puerta creció, movió sus hojas y sus nidos, movió la elevación de su follaje. Árbol era, natural, generoso, manzano, manzanar o manzanero, y las palabras brillaban en su copa inagotable, opacas o sonoras, fecundas en la fonda del lenguaje, cargadas de verdad y de sonido. Aparto una sola de sus páginas. Caporal, capuchón. ¡Qué maravilla pronunciar estas sílabas con aire! Y más abajo, cápsula, hueca y esperando aceite o ambrosía, y junto a ellas, captura, capucete, capuchino, caprario, captatorio, palabras que se deslizan como suaves uvas o que a la luz estallan como gérmenes ciegos que esperaron en la bodega del vocabulario y vienen otra vez y dan la vida. Una vez más, el corazón las quema. Diccionario, no eres tumba, sepulcro, féretro, túmulo, mausoleo, sino preservación, fuego escondido, plantación de rubíes, perpetuidad viviente de la esencia y granero del idioma. Y es hermoso recoger en tus filas la palabra de estirpe, la severa y olvidada sentencia, hija de España, endurecida como reja de arado, fija en su límite de anticuada herramienta preservada con su hermosura exacta y su dureza de medalla. O la otra palabra que ahí vimos perdida entre renglones y que de pronto se hizo sabrosa y lisa en nuestra boca como una almendra o tierna como un higo. Diccionario: una mano de tus mil manos, una de tus mil esmeraldas, una sola gota de tus vertientes virginales, un grano de tus magnánimos graneros, en el momento justo a mis labios conduce, al hilo de mi pluma, a mi tintero. De tu espesa y sonora profundidad de selva, dame, cuando lo necesite, un solo trino, el lujo de una abeja, un fragmento caído de tu antigua madera perfumada por una eternidad de jazmineros. Una sílaba, un temblor, un sonido, una semilla. De tierra soy y con palabras canto.
Uy, qué buen poeta era Pablo Neruda, ¿eh?
Un gran poema. Es un poema que te va llevando a través de su propia experiencia en relación al diccionario, y que entra al diccionario y te hace oír las palabras y saborea las palabras, las sientes como si estuviera se las estuviera comiendo, y después le agradece por darle la palabra exacta en el momento correcto. Que eso, Leopoldo, es lo que todos los escritores soñamos que ocurra, no que nos llegue cualquier palabra, sino que nos llegue la palabra correcta en el momento indicado, porque esa es la que vale.
Sí, ¿por qué no nos lees ahora la de... ¿Cuál te gusta, la sandía o la cebolla?
¿Por qué no te leo la de la cebolla, que es una oda muy hermosa también?
A ver.
Invito nuevamente a tus radioescuchas a pensar, como Neruda, en una cebolla. ¿Qué es? ¿Cómo se ve una cebolla? ¿Qué papel juega en nuestras vidas? ¿Qué hacemos con ella? ¿Cómo está construida la arquitectura de una cebolla y la gramática de una cebolla? Cebolla, luminosa redoma, pétalo a pétalo se formó tu hermosura, escamas de cristal te acrecentaron, y en el secreto de la tierra oscura se redondeó tu vientre de rocío. Bajo la tierra fue el milagro, y cuando apareció tu torpe tallo verde y nacieron tus hojas como espadas en el huerto, la tierra acumuló su poderío mostrando tu desnuda transparencia, y como en Afrodita, el mar remoto duplicó la magnolia levantando sus senos. La tierra así te hizo, cebolla, clara como un planeta y destinada a relucir, constelación constante, redonda rosa de agua sobre la mesa de las pobres gentes. Generosa, deshaces tu globo de frescura en la consumación ferviente de la olla, y el jirón de cristal al calor encendido del aceite se transforma en rizada pluma de oro. También recordaré cómo fecunda tu influencia el amor de la ensalada, y parece que el cielo contribuye dándote fina forma de granizo a celebrar tu claridad picada sobre los hemisferios de un tomate. Pero al alcance de las manos del pueblo, regada con aceite, empolvoreada con un poco de sal, matas el hambre del jornalero en el duro camino. Estrella de los pobres, hada madrina envuelta en delicado papel, sales del suelo eterna, intacta, pura, como semilla de astro, y al cortarte el cuchillo en la cocina, sube la única lágrima sin pena. Nos hiciste llorar sin afligirnos. Y cuando existe, celebré, cebolla, pero para mí eres más hermosa que un ave de plumas segadoras. Eres para mis ojos globo celeste, copa de platino, baile inmóvil de anémona nevada, y vive la fragancia de la tierra en tu naturaleza cristalina.
El campo. Como bien comentabas, el campeón de la significancia de lo insignificante.
Exactamente, te hace ver ahí la cebolla en la ensalada, en los hemisferios del tomate. Te hace ver que la cebolla es el astro de la pureza y también la esperanza de los pobres. Y que la cebolla te hace llorar sin afligirte, que es exactamente lo que nos causa cuando la cortamos.
Al rato, cuando el programa vaya a acabar, yo voy a leer, pero al rato, el que es el mi favorito, como de cualquier cualquier latinoamericano que está enamorado, que es el poema 19.
Perfecto.
El poema 19, el de la niña morena y ágil. Al rato lo voy a leer ese yo. Pero ahora, Ilan, déjame cambiar al inglés, porque me gustaría mucho que también nos leyeras los poemas en inglés. Déjame cambiar al inglés para hacerte la siguiente pregunta en inglés. So, switching to English, in the book has the odes both in English and in Spanish face to face, and Ilan wrote in the introduction that for a translator that is like being handcuffed. Could you first please elaborate more on the perils of translating poetry, you know, into a different language? I assume it's not such an easy thing to do. I mean, translating anything is difficult, but translating poetry should be super difficult. And then, would you like to read the same poems in English?
Sure. Translating, Leopoldo, as you well said, is, I would say it's an impossible task. It's not only a difficult task, it's an impossible task. And I use the word impossible because as a translator, and I don't pretend to speak on behalf of all the translators, but I assume some of them would empathize with what I'm saying. I know that the poem that lives in the original needs to live, to exist, to come alive in the new language, in the language to which you're translating. And in order to do that, you have to walk a very thin line that between loyalty and creativity. To what extent do you need to be loyal to every single word that Neruda, in this case, wrote in Spanish? And to what extent do you have to be loyal to the meaning of the sentence or of that word, but not to the word itself? Can you be loyal and truthful at the same time, or can you be truthful by becoming disloyal? And that is, those are the perils of the translator in general, but certainly in poetry, because poetry pays more attention to words than any other form of writing. In poetry, every single word on the page seems to be clamoring for attention, to be isolated, to be seen on its own. I love translation because I live in translation. I am an immigrant to this country, and I grew up in Mexico, my native country, in a multilingual environment. And today, in a single day, in a single hour, in a single minute, I can go back and forth from one language to another. And those are two worlds that are colliding or that are getting married in those languages. So the act and art of translation is very much infused in my way of being. I think it's infused in the society in which we live. And because I love poetry, and I think poetry does something that nothing else can do, I dream of paying tribute to poetry by failing as a translator to do my job, and knowing that failure is done with the effort that it will not be a failure, that it will bring some sort of success. So I guess the conclusion to this thought, Leopoldo, is that there is no translation that I finish that is satisfying, that makes me happy. And when I reread it, there is something always that begs to change, begs to be transformed. But maybe that is what life is all about, changing things. To what extent are we finished human beings? We're always upgrading and updating ourselves in front of others. So I don't run back to the page if it's already published, if I consider it a finished translation, because it is a contract that I have with the reader. But when I read it, when I read one that I will read right now, I cringe inside thinking, was that the right choice that I made? And that is because there's a difference between being a creative writer and being a translator. In a creative writer, you are in command of the imagination and the way you're going to capture that imagination in words. Whereas in translation, somebody else is in command of the imagination, and you are bringing that imagination to a new language, into a new culture. It's very important to distinguish between language and culture, because you don't only translate to another language, you translate to another culture that has that language. In words change. For instance, if I use the word cool in a translation, what the reader will hear in English is not only cold, but the hip. Mm-hmm. This is cool. So one needs to understand what the cultural landscape in the context of words are, and in that sense, every translation is an approximation to the time in which the reader will find it, but it is likely to age as language changes. So the translations of today are most likely going to look like relics of the past in 20 years or in 30 years. So let me read you the translation of into English, mm-hmm. of Ode to the Dictionary, mm-hmm. and you will see how different or similar it is. This translation, I did it myself. The volume contains 18 different translators, and of those 18 different translators, many of them having translations of various odes, there are different strategies. Some are more loyal and some are more truthful. I don't necessarily think that one is better than the other. Mm-hmm. Black like an ox, beast of burden, systematic, dense book. Young, I ignored you. I was visited by smugness, and I thought myself complete. And plump, like a melancholy toad, I proclaimed, I receive words directly from the roaring Mount Sinai. I shall reduce forms into alchemy. I am a magus. The great magus said nothing. The dictionary, old and heavy, with its scuffy leather jacket, was silent, its test tubes undisplayed. But one day, after having used it and reused it, after declaring it a useless and anachronistic camel, when for long months, without protest, it served as an armchair and a pillow, it rebelled and planted itself in my doorstep. It expanded, shook its leaves and nests. It moved the elevation of its foliage. It was tree, neutral, generous, apple tree, apple orchard, or apple blossom. And the words, shining in their inexhaustible cup, opaque or sonorous, fertile in the lodging of language, charged with truth and sound. I turned to a single one of its pages. Cape. Cartridge. How wonderful to pronounce the syllables with air. And further on, capsule. Hollow. Awaiting all or ambrosia. And near the end, captivate. Capture. Capuchin. Carousel. Carpathian. Words as slippery as smooth grapes, or exploding in the light like blind seeds awaiting in the storehouse of vocabulary, alive again and given life. Once again, the heart is burning them. Dictionary, you are not tomb, sepulcher, coffin, tumulus, mausoleum, but preservation, hidden fire, plantation of rubies, living eternity of essence, granary of language. And it is wonderful to harvest in your fields a lineage of words, the severe and forgotten sentence, daughter of Spain, hardened like a plow blade, fixed in its limit of antiquated tool, preserved in its exact beauty and the immutability of a medallion. Or another word we find hiding between lines that suddenly seems as delicious and smooth in our mouths as an almond or as tender as a fig. Dictionary. Let one of your thousand hands, one of your thousand emeralds, a single drop of your virginal springs, one grain of your magnanimous granaries fall at the right moment on my lips, the thread of my pen, into my inkwell. From the dense and sonorous depths of your jungle, give me, when I needed a single birdsong, the luxury of a bee, the fallen fragment of your ancient wood perfumed by an eternity of jasmine. One syllable, one tremor, one sound, one seed. I am made of earth, and with words I sing.
Y el verso cae al alma como al pasto el rocío. Which is another famous line of Neruda's, the famous canción desesperada. Thank you, Ilan. Let me please play another song, and then when we come back, we continue speaking about Pablo Neruda and your book, All the Oats. By the way, if you wanna speak about it, people can find it, I guess, online or whatever, right?
And in bookstores, it's available in bookstores, on Amazon, and on the website of the publisher Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
All right, so let me play another song. Before that, let me remind to the people listening to us that this is a phone drive week. If you want to contribute to WMUA, the phone number for doing that is 413-577-3000. And you can also do it online on WMUA.org.
Que te ames, si tú no me quieres ya, el amor que ya ha pasado no se debe recordar, fui la ilusión de tu vida, un día lejano. Hoy represento el pasado, no me puedo conformar. ¿Qué te importa que te ames si tú no quieres el amor que ya ha pasado? No. Fui la ilusión de tu vida, un día no cambia. Hoy represento el pasado, no me puedo conformar.
años.
Yo 9.
Yo 4.5.
Y sufro de asma.
Quizás no sepas todo lo que puede causarme un ataque de asma,
ni cómo combatirlo.
Mete los peluches en el congelador para eliminar los ácaros del polvo.
Seca los juguetes de baño
y repara las goteras para eliminar el moho, que también puede provocarme un ataque.
Descubre otras formas de prevenir un ataque de asma. Llama al 1-866-NO-ATTACKS o visita noattacks.org.
No me quiero sentir como un pez fuera del agua.
Patrocinado por el USEPA y el Ad Council.
Would you like to get lawn mowing, dog walking, or French lessons without opening your wallet? Believe it or not, you can, and much, much more. Valley Time Trade members earn time dollars by helping other members. One time dollar is 1 hour of service. All services are valued the same, and no cash is involved. Give services you want. Get services you need. To learn more or join, go to valleytimetrade.org or call 413-585-0373.
Is it a rainy day in MA? Instantly travel to sunny Brazil and indulge your senses without even leaving your home. Experience the vibrant sound of the country of Carnaval, Copacabana, and the Corcovado. Immerse yourself in samba, bossa nova, choro, and the other exotic rhythms that flavor each region of Brazil. So make sure to grab your cup of coffee as you sit back and let the music transport you to the streets of Brazil. Tune in to Cafe Brazil with Melanie, Thursday afternoons from 12 to 2:30 on WMUA Amherst.
Welcome back to Tan Cerca Tan Lejos. We are in the annual phone drive of WMUA. If you would like to contribute, the phone number is 413-577-3000. You could also contribute online. You go to the webpage WMUA.org and you're going to find the link there. Continuing the interview with Professor Ilan Estabans from Amherst College. Ilan, You wrote as well, I didn't know, by the way, in the introduction to the book you just published, that Neruda is arguably the all-time best-selling foreign language poet in the United States. I was quite surprised. Eh? I didn't even imagine something like that. What is that the case? How come?
Yeah, it's a very interesting phenomenon. Neruda died in 1973, as we said earlier on. And still he remains a very popular poet, a poet that manages to find new readers every generation. And he particularly connects Leopoldo with young people. He is the poet of eternal youth, the poet of idealism, the poet of hope, the poet of perseverance and endurance, and the poet of love, of modern love. And so every time there is a revolt, or there is a march, or there is a championing of lost causes, Neruda comes along and accompanies those that are involved in that civil engagement. And every time somebody falls in love, because of the nature of his words, they revoke, they return to Neruda. There is something in Neruda's poetry, and it's not easy to define it and describe it. There is something in his poetry that feels to me as if you are putting your hand in a pure and crystalline river and getting it soaked, and then you get the hand out, and the river continues. The language of Neruda is a language that flows harmoniously, effortlessly, and he shares it with us. It doesn't feel cumbersome, it doesn't feel belabored, it feels authentic, it feels sincere. Of course, there are some poems that are more in touch with people than others, or people are more in touch with poems, but I would like to actually think is the original way around. I don't think that people choose poems. I don't think that that we go to books. I think that books choose us. And I think poems choose us. And I think Neruda's poetry chooses young people, and people feel that that choice is theirs. I am always amazed by the popularity of his works in Latin America, all over. But during the Arab Spring, Neruda was in Syria and in Egypt and in Tunisia, And during the revolts in the former Soviet Union, Neruda was in Prague and Neruda was in Budapest. And in the United States, with occupied Wall Street, Neruda was always a companion of people against the censorship and against imperialism and against colonialism. And in the age of the internet, where we think, when we think that people have lost the capacity, at least we that are a little older, the capacity to date, to court someone, everything seems to be so easy, so instantaneous with your iPhone or with the Instagram and Facebook, Neruda pops up through a quote or through a poem, and he does it in translation. You know, translations, I would say that there are very few poets that can survive translation, and Neruda does. Neruda, in spite of our efforts, we tried our best, but they are translations. Neruda survives and feels as if he's authentic. And there's something absolutely unique. I think there's something absolutely celestial in him. I don't know how else to explain it. I can tell you that his books sell very well in this country. They are very popular. I myself teach on a cyclical basis a course at Amherst College on Neruda, and I'm teaching it this semester, and I am always flabbergasted by how people that have never been exposed to Neruda, youngs, 18, 19, all of a sudden read him for the first time, and they are struck. They are hypnotized. They have become new, and they start seeing life differently. And as a teacher, it's a joyful moment because you feel that you have introduced them to Neruda, but you also know that now they are in the hands of Neruda, that your job has been completed, has been done. You know, Leopoldo, I wasn't a reader of poetry when I was growing up. I was a rough and tumble reader of novels and nonfiction, and I thought that poetry was it was too delicate for me. Mm-hmm. It was too isolated. And I was telling you about a student who introduced me to Neruda at one point, the very first student that I had, who invited me to his wedding and said, Ilan, would you read a poem in my wedding? And I said, well, I'm not really a reader of poetry or a reciter of poetry. And he said, you are. And I know the poem that you're going to recite, and here it is. It's called Tus Manos, Your Hands, by Pablo Neruda. Or you have an option, Tu Risa, Your Laughter, by Pablo Neruda. And I said, give them to me and I'll choose. And I read them and I realized that of course I had to do it, but there was something more, that now he was in me, in that I needed to go deeper into Neruda's poetry. And I'll tell you, I invite your listeners and I invite you, just open that poem, Your Laughter. I can't conceive of somebody else, any other poet, describing a lover's laughter in such delicate and powerful way. Who cares who the lover is? The fact is that that laughter is absolutely essential and pristine.
Yeah, here it is. Your Laughter by Pablo Neruda. Actually, I'm going to read that one later, but now I'm going to take the freedom to read this other one I was speaking to you about, my favorite one, the poem 19 of the 20 love poems and the desperate song. And this is a wonderful poem, in my view. It's about this guy who is in love with a brown woman, however, she's not in love with him. Let me read it. And
please, you were just
mentioning how Neruda really touches young people. I cannot imagine like a teenager who would not be absolutely thrilled by this poem. Let me read it. It says, el sol que hace las frutas, el que cuaja los trigos, el que tuerce las algas, hizo tu cuerpo alegre, tus luminosos ojos y tu boca que tiene la sonrisa del agua. Un sol negro y ansioso se te arrolla en las hebras de la negra melena cuando estiras los brazos. Tú juegas con el sol como con un estero y él te deja en los ojos dos oscuros remansos. Niña morena y ágil, nada a ti me acerca, todo de a ti me aleja como del mediodía. Eres la delirante juventud de la abeja, la embriaguez de la ola, la fuerza de la espiga. Mi corazón sombrío te busca, sin embargo, y amo tu cuerpo alegre, tu voz suelta y delgada, mariposa morena dulce y definitiva, como el trigal y el sol, la amapola y el agua. Switching to Spanish, ¿cómo puede ser un adolescente
y no quedar transformado por este poema? Absolutamente. En el poema siguiente, en la misma colección, uh-huh. el poema 20, puedo escribir los versos más tristes de esta noche. Escribir, por ejemplo, la noche está estrellada y ella, y tiritan de lejos los astros en el cielo. Hay una frase, there's one sentence that is essential and that always travels with me, where Neruda says, es tan corto el amor y es tan largo el olvido. I think that if he had only written that sentence, we would still remember him. That sentence alone merits his inclusion in the shelf of immortal poets.
Why don't we listen to another song quickly, and then when we come back from the song, we finish the interview. I would really appreciate if you could wait.
Of course, 10 more minutes. Go ahead.
So let's listen to one more song from Omar Aportuondo from Cuba.
Suspendimos el bembé.
Oye,
This is WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst. Let me tell you that Tan Cerca y Tan Lejos is made possible by listeners like you and Hotel UMass, located in the heart of the UMass campus with 116 contemporary guest rooms, 36 meeting rooms, wireless internet, complimentary parking, and continental breakfast. Hotel UMass is walking distance to downtown Amherst and programs all over campus. More information is at umasshotel.com. WMUA thanks Hotel UMass for their kind support. And let me also tell you that we are in the annual phone drive week here at WMUA. This is the last day. It would be very, very good if we were going to reach our goal this year, which is $40,000. We are very close to that. It would be very good for me if we could reach such a goal during my show. I would be very happy. So I encourage you to please contribute to WMUA. The phone number for doing that is 413-577-3000. Or you can also do it online. Go to the webpage, WMUA.org. And let me finish the interview with Professor Ilan Stavans, and let me finish it in Spanish. It's time to speak Spanish now. So let me switch to Spanish. Ilan, bueno, pues ahora sí que pues muchas gracias por venir al programa. Bueno, gracias por el libro. Vamos a checarlo. Y algo más que tú quieras agregar.
Bueno, quiero agradecerte muchísimo. Ha sido encantador, revelador. Esta conversación, hablar de Neruda y permitir que Neruda nos hable no solo a nosotros, sino a través de nosotros a los demás, siempre es una ocasión bienvenida. Quizá le diría a tus radioescuchas que la literatura latinoamericana es una de las puertas de entrada a América Latina, a entender cómo funciona esta mente latinoamericana, esta idiosincrasia latinoamericana, y que saber leer es saber vivir. Hay que tener paciencia con los libros, hay que tener paciencia con los escritores, como hay que tener paciencia con los padres o con los amigos o con los amantes. Este semestre estoy dando un curso sobre Neruda, el próximo daré un curso sobre Don Quijote, que es una novela que no es latinoamericana, pero que nosotros los latinoamericanos hemos latinoamericanizado, de tal manera en que uno la entiende hoy como un viaje en busca de la propia identidad de un cincuentón, que aunque ocurre en La Mancha en realidad es el continente de América Latina. Y pues quizá tengo siempre estudiantes de UMass que son encantadores, que combinan e interactúan con los estudiantes de los cinco colleges, y I'm looking forward to it.
Te voy a hacer una última pregunta, si a bote pronto, ahorita que mencionabas que la literatura latinoamericana es un punto de entrada para conocer la mente latinoamericana. Si tuvieras que escoger así cinco escritores para el público que quiere entrar a la cultura latinoamericana, y ya sé que esta pregunta es así a bote pronto, ¿qué escogerías?
Cinco escritores latinoamericanos para entender la mente, la psique, la cultura latinoamericana. Ahí te van. Yo empezaría con la gran poeta monja mexicana, Sor Juana. Uh-huh. Hombres necios que acusáis a la mujer sin razón. Sus sonetos, sus redondillas, sobre todo su primero sueño, son extraordinarios. Yo incluiría ahí, quizá antes que Sor Juana, pero a Borges. Borges es la figura canónica, el que nos universalizó. Incluiría a García Márquez y a una obra de García Márquez en particular, que creo que es la Biblia de América Latina, 100 años de soledad, un libro que yo releo todos los años y que me ha enseñado que no solamente nosotros crecemos y maduramos, sino que los libros crecen y maduran con nosotros, o viceversa. Yo pondría a Pablo Neruda como el cuarto, y hemos discutido por qué en esta conversación. Y el quinto, Leopoldo, es el escritor que está escribiendo ahora y que tú y yo todavía no conocemos, pero que nos hará ver América Latina de una forma totalmente desconocida y que me urge descubrir.
Pues por allá de andar.
Ahí debe andar.
Bueno, pues muchas gracias, Ilan. ¿Algo más que quieras agregar?
No, te agradezco muchísimo. El libro de All the Odes, Todas las Odas, de Pablo Neruda, está a la venta en librerías, en el internet, está publicado por Amazon.com, por Arch Travels and Giroux, da la impresión que Amazon lo hace todo. Amazon es la es el dios de Estados Unidos actual. Y invito a los radioescuchas el 21 de noviembre en el 92nd Street Y, en Manhattan. Vamos a hacer un evento celebratorio en derredor del libro, en el cual van a estar algunos de los grandes poetas norteamericanos actuales y que han sido traductores de Neruda, como Paul Muldoon, que es el editor de poesía del New Yorker, y Philip Levine, que es el que tradujo La Oda a la Cebolla y que fue el poeta laureado de Poet Laureate de los Estados Unidos, y también Edward Hirsch, uno de los grandes poetas norteamericanos. Todos nosotros leyendo la poesía de Neruda a las 7 en The 92nd Street Y en Nueva York, una semana antes del Día de Gracias de Thanksgiving.
Quizás quisieras decir eso en inglés para la gente que solo habla inglés.
Claro, invito. I invite everybody to an event to celebrate the publication of All the Oats of Pablo Neruda, the book that we have been talking about, at the 92nd Street Y in New York City on November 21st, a Thursday at 7 p.m. And I will host in it a number of prominent English language, American and Irish poets such as Paul Muldoon, Philip Levine, the poet laureate of the United States, and also Edward Hirsch, all of us reading the poetry of Pablo Neruda both in Spanish and in English, and reflecting on the role that Pablo Neruda has had in our individual and national lives.
Thank you, Ilan. Finally, I'm going to invite you to come back to the show one day. You just mentioned to me that you just translated El Llano en Llamas of Juan Rulfo, the Mexican writer, and maybe one of these days you could come back and we could speak about El Llano en Llamas of Juan Rulfo.
It would be a big pleasure. El Llano en Llamas contains some of the very best short stories ever written in Spanish, particularly one that is called No Oyes Ladrar Los Perros, You Don't Hear the Doors Barking. That story alone could justify the life of any writer, and it is astonishing. I would love to discuss it with you.
Thank you very much, Ian. Well, this is Tan Cerca, Tan Lejos. Let's continue listening to Cuban music.
Y aunque tú me has echado en el abandono, y aunque tú ha muerto mi ilusión, en vez de maldecirte con justo encono, y en mis sueños te como, y en mis sueños te como de bendiciones. Sufro la inmensa pena de tu extravío, que el llanto mío tiene lágrimas negras, tiene lágrimas negras como mi vida.
lágrimas negras, tiene lágrimas negras como mi mía. Hay viento Guadalquivir, la gitana al lado, los niños en la orilla viendo los barcos pasar.